Okay, welcome everybody. This is the seventh lecture for the Mises Academy class, Production in the Market Process, our tour of the middle of man, economy, and state. So, I thought it would be good just to follow up on one train of thought from the last lecture. I alluded to this, but we didn't really totally walk you through this last part of it. So don't worry, I think this might be the last time you have to look at these diagrams, except when it comes to the final exam. So here we have on the left side the original economy, and then on the right side we have the possibility, right? So again, this just to reiterate that from the last lecture, this new economy that I dreamed up on the right here with seven stages and an interest rate of 3% and so forth, a lot of the particulars of that I just made up. Okay, that's one possible economy that satisfies a lot of the criteria that have to be true for the transition that Rothbard described. But you could dream up other economies with different numbers that would be equally valid. And in fact, last time I mentioned that I think actually there's a little bit of a problem with this one in terms of making some of the stages shorter and some of the stages longer. But anyway, what I wanted to point out today, just very briefly, in case this was puzzling some of you, there's two things going on when we say that the economies or that in the transition the consumers cut back on consumption, and so nominal spending drops to 80 ounces of gold, but that the real real income or real consumption, I should say, goes up. Okay, there's two different things going on here. In this particular diagram or this particular illustration, it's actually going to take 7 years to get in that new, or seven time periods, whatever the time unit of length is, for the increased output to happen. So, is that true? Well, it depends how we frame it, okay? But the point is, let me just walk you through this. It could take up to 7 years, I'll put it that way. All right, and again, this is getting really particular. And by the way, this is a really subtle thing here, and so, If you lose me on this one slide, I'm not going to spend too much time on it tonight. Don't worry. I'm just trying to seal the deal for those people who are really trying to think this through and we're getting a little bit mixed up. So if what you're picturing as to how these people actually end up having a higher standard of living indefinitely because they engaged in this temporary abstention from consumption, If the way we're picturing it is that they just open up this new seventh stage that's brand new that wasn't being done before, then it'll take time for that to come out the other end, right? So you're doing that, they open that up, and then it rolls over the next stage, and it rolls over, and it rolls over, and rolls over, and rolls over, and then it's not until 7 years later that those people now have more actual goods and services being produced, consumer goods and services being produced, that with their lower nominal expenditure of 80 ounces of gold now buys you know, more actual goods and services for the consumer. So the difficulty is Rothbard never really spells out, nor does Hayek, well, I can't remember if Hayek spells this out anywhere, but Rothbard certainly does not actually give you precise technological relationships and tells you in this economy how many units of goods and services, or sorry, how many units of land and labor factors are getting put in, and then what they physically turn into, and then what they physically turn into here, and what they physically da-da-da-da-da-da. And so you can't really see how does the economy physically transform so that it's using a different production process, right? Because that has to be true, that it's to go from this configuration, this whole diagram over here, to this configuration over here, I mean, there's something is physically different about how resources are turned into consumption goods. Just like if you remember back the example I used with you guys for showing the superior physical productivity of more roundabout processes. Remember I said, imagine there's a guy out in the woods and he's trying to get water from a stream to his cottage, and the very direct route of using his labor directly is just to keep running back and forth, cupping the water in his hands. And that's very quick. You know, he can start moving cups of water into his cottage very soon after he starts the project by using his raw labor power. But the volume of water per unit labor time expended is pretty low. And so if he's willing to defer the point at which that water starts hitting his house, then for a given input of labor time measured in hours, or you know, measured in minutes, whatever, he can have a higher physical quantity measured in volume terms of water being delivered to his cottage per hour of his labor. But the trade-off there is he's got to wait. It'll take longer to get it there, but the point is once it does get there, he's going to get more gallons of water per hour of labor that he put into the whole project. So the problem, or not the problem, but what I want you to see there is even though you can reckon it in those terms and look at it in terms of increasing the physical quantity of water per unit labor time expended, the way that technologically that manifests itself or is accomplished is you're using a totally different process. So you're not running back and forth with your hands cupped. No, instead, if you can afford to wait, you go climb a tree and grab a coconut, and then go find a rock and smash it open, and then find another rock and hollow out the coconut. So now you've created a capital good. And then, you know, 3 hours into it, now that you've got this nice bowl that you just made, you can start running back and forth. And so the point again is, if you add up all the labor time you put into it, including the labor time in climbing the tree and hollowing out the coconut shell and so forth, then it's still the case that the total amount of water divided by total amount of labor hours is bigger using that second approach. But of course, the time delay is there, so you got to take that into account. So if you were trying to diagram that like this versus that, you see, it wouldn't just be a matter of adding a new stage at the top. It's possible that the whole way you go about turning labor power and raw natural resources into the consumption good is different. Whereas sometimes if you're just thinking about these things in terms of the abstract diagrams without thinking of a physical production process, it seems like, oh, we're just slapping on a new thing at the top. And so my point is it's tricky to think through what would it actually mean for a society to make the transition from one relatively less roundabout production process to one that's more roundabout. So if that was tripping you up, I just want to confirm that is a subtlety. And so this also addresses the question when you say, well, how long would society have to wait for there to be an increased flow of consumption goods? So for sure, there's at least one period where society where there's fewer consumption goods. Okay, because when the people start saving more, I mean, they redirect resources. Resources flow out of this stage right here when you move to this stage. You get what I'm saying? That so because the consumers spend less on one period, Here's the thing. Let me just walk you through this too, but you guys might not have been thinking it through like this. And it's sort of interesting. Strictly speaking, real consumption doesn't drop that first period when there's the higher savings. Because at that point, the consumption goods were already produced, or they were, you know, just getting the finishing touches put on them. Right? So it's true the retailers are going to be horrified when all of a sudden they thought they were going to sell all these consumption goods for 100 ounces of gold, and instead they can only get 80 ounces. They might suffer losses if they didn't see that coming. But the point is, the consumption goods aren't just going to rot on the shelves, assuming the prices are flexible and all that stuff. The prices will fall to clear the market. So even though the consumers are only spending 80 ounces of gold on consumption goods because now they're saving more, the consumption goods that were already physically produced, somebody's going to consume them. I mean, if you wanted to make it more realistic, you might say that the owners of the grocery stores ate more of them or something. I mean, it's not necessarily the workers and their role as consumers. It can be the entrepreneur, the capitalist at that stage, if you want to think of it that way. But my point is, if it's cans of tuna fish or something, if that's what we're picturing as the consumption good, those things aren't physically destroyed because consumers all of a sudden change their spending habits. So it's actually not in the period when the change is first made that real consumption drops. Monetary expenditures on consumption drop, but however many cans of tuna fish were originally going to be consumed, they're going to be consumed in this period also, even though there's an increase in savings. But what happens is next period, you're not going to have as many actual cans of tuna fish being produced, because once that shock happens and now the grocery store owners take huge losses, well, then they're not buying the second order goods, as many second order goods as they would have before. And so that the process that would have had to have been in motion so that next period the same number of cans of tuna fish are produced, now the thing that needed to happen in the period before isn't happening as much, because that stage is also getting decimated. And so that's why there's going to be a reduction in the actual flow of consumer goods coming on the pipeline. But in terms of, you know, the ones that were already on their way to the store, they're already made. The resources have already been channeled into making those consumption goods. So real consumption, ironically, doesn't drop during the time period in which the households change their spending behavior. It's only in the next period when you start to see an actual decline in real consumption. And so what I'm saying is, in general, we really don't know. I can't tell you when the households will see a permanently higher flow of real consumption goods because of their increased savings. You'd have to get more specific about what was the production process before and then what was it after they switched to the new higher level of savings. So you do know that once you get into the new ERE, there's going to be a permanently higher real flow of consumption output every period, even though it's being chased by or purchased by 80 ounces of gold in terms of monetary expenditure each period. And it's just got to be the case that in equilibrium, the price of those consumer goods is low enough so that the 80 ounces of gold can purchase the whole output of consumer goods. So what I'm getting at is there might be up to seven periods, intermediate periods here, where the production structure, where these horizontal bars are changing from period to period. And so it would be neat. And I actually started on this path one time, and then I got bogged down with other stuff, and I never finished it out. But it would be neat if someone did a scholarly journal article spelling this out, because I don't think we have such a thing in the, that from a purely Austrian perspective, to show the actual transition from the initial ERE to the new ERE, that there might be intermediate stages while the stuff works its way down the production chain. And so in that case, depending on how the process is physically different, it could take up to 7 time periods for the consumers to see that new stuff flow out. Now, it might not take as much because, again, it depends on how they tweak it. And I think that's probably what Rothbard had in mind. I think Rothbard wasn't picturing that the lion's share of it all goes to this new stage, and then you got to wait for it to all flow out. I think, he was imagining that, yeah, there's a lot concentrated at that new stage, but that some of the extra investment gets dispersed among several of the higher order stages. So if you looked at, this stage right here, if that's the stage where there's a net gain, because remember Rothbard shows there's a shrinkage in spending at the lower stages, and at the higher stages there's an increase. And so there's, a part in the triangle, the Hayekian triangle, where the two opposing forces roughly cancel out. So if you look at that stage, at the lowest stage for which there was a net increase in investment spending, well, then if you just keep following that down, however many time periods that stage is away from consumption, I think Rothbard would argue that's when the households are going to start seeing the benefit of their increased saving in real terms. But up until that point, there's going to be, consumption every period is going to be lower than real consumption is going to be lower than it otherwise was. So if you think of it in terms of the lowest stage taking the biggest hit, and then the hit gets smaller and smaller as you go up, I think the way Rothbard is picturing it is that, let's say initially there was 100 cans of tuna fish coming out, then the next period after the saving kicks in, maybe there's only 90 cans of tuna fish coming out, so there's a big reduction in real consumption, but then the next period there's 91, the next period maybe there's 93, the next period there's 96, and then 98, and then maybe 100, 5 periods later. So after 5 periods, you finally gotten back to where you were, but then in the 6th period, there's 102, and in the 7th period, now there's 105, let's say. Again, I'm just making these numbers up. And so even though every period you keep spending the same 80 ounces of gold on consumption, the price of tuna fish keeps going down in terms of gold ounces, so that, originally took a huge hit, and then you start recovering, and then finally at some point you've surpassed where you were in the original ERE. And so then from that point onward, your standard of living is permanently higher because you were willing, you had the time preference change, and you had the patience to endure a temporary drop in your real consumption. So that's what you're doing. So let me just make sure you guys are getting the big picture here. Just like a regular household, just in terms of financial considerations, if you're willing to save more in the present, what happens? Well, you have to cut back on consumption. That's the only way you can do it for a given income. If you want to save more, if you want to put more in your bank account or put more in the stock market or buy more bonds for a given income, the only way you can do that is if you cut back on your consumption. So that's not pleasurable. You like to consume, but you got to cut back on that stuff to save more. But then you can eventually that. So let's say you originally were saving 5% of your income, and now you start saving 10% of your income. If you run the numbers on that, eventually your consumption will be higher than it was in the original scenario. But it'll take you a few years to get there, depending on what the interest rate is. Because initially, you take a big hit in your consumption, but when you switch to the higher savings rate, But then your income now, every period after that, is higher than it otherwise would have been, because now, in addition to your paycheck or whatever, you're earning more interest income off of your growing pool of savings. Because every year now you're putting aside more than you originally would have. And so at some point, even though you're consuming a lower fraction of your income is so much higher than it otherwise would have been that, the consuming 90% times your income gives a bigger number than originally consuming 95% of your income times whatever your income was, that number would have been. Okay, but it might take a few years for you to grow into that. So that's the idea. So just like you can see it in terms of if prices were the same and you were just dealing with how much money you had to spend, and you could make that your income grow in monetary terms if you saved a higher fraction every year. If you see how that works in terms of a household's budget, what we're showing you here is how that physically is possible with the economy as a whole. So what I'm trying to get you to see is everybody can have a permanently higher standard of living measured in real terms if we all start saving more. So it's not that one person can save more, but that means somebody else has to be running up big debts. That everybody in the whole community can save a higher fraction of his or her income, and we can all have a permanently higher standard of living. And the way that's possible, again, is because when the economy transforms into a more roundabout production process, that makes the physical productivity of all the land and labor factors higher. And since we have the same amount of land and labor factors every period to be deployed somehow, once we wait and get through that adjustment period, and now we hit the part where the full flow of consumption goods is coming out of the pipeline in the new ERE configuration, now with those same configuration of land and labor resources to work with, every period we get a permanently higher flow of real output or real consumption goods, I should say. All right, so that's how, in terms of engineering or physics or technology, whatever you want to say, that's how it's possible that people making what seems to be a financial decision can allow us to have this thing that involves real tangible goods and services. Okay. If you want to see more about it, and again, this is all optional stuff. Okay, but I just wanted to clarify that because it's kind of important. I wanted to make sure you guys were seeing the big picture. If you were intrigued by that kind of stuff and want to see this thing spelled out, ironically, Paul Samuelson, the arch enemy of Austrian economics, the godfather of mainstream Keynesian neoclassical mathematical economics, Paul Samuelson has the coolest illustration of this that I've ever seen. Where he's and the reason he comes up with it is to say that Bombavrik is wrong, but who cares? It is a very clever, simple illustration. He dreams up an economy that was in one configuration, and then switches to a more roundabout process, so that there's a temporary drop in consumption, and then it goes up, and it's but he shows how the anyway he shows how society can efficiently make the transition from one to the other by wasting as few resources or by making consumption drop as little as possible to move from one configuration to another. And he's trying to critique Bombavrik, so Samuelson is thinking in Bombavrikian terms, and it's like I say, it's a very clever little thing. So if you want to see more about that, then go look at this article I wrote a few years ago, and then go look up the actual Samuelson paper that I cite in that paper if you want to see the diagrams he had to see. So in other words, what Samuelson does is he comes up with actual numbers and production processes, like technology, recipes, to illustrate this sort of thing, going from this kind of economy to that economy. But you actually can see what the technology is in both states and how the people could efficiently move from one to the other. And you can see, like, he has a timeline and shows you in period one, this is how many bottles of champagne are coming out in period two. This is what happens in period three, and you can see the transition and all that stuff. So it's pretty neat. So if for no other reason than just to clarify the Austrian worldview on this stuff. Like I say, Samuelson does that to then conclude von Bavrick is wrong, and I try to defend von Bavrick in this Mises.org article, but it's well worth looking at that stuff if you're interested. Obviously, I'm not testing you on that. I'm just letting you know it's out there. Okay, so now we're coming back to the stuff in the new chapter, what are we on, chapter 9? Yeah, it's chapter 9. And some of this is going to be overlapping with the things I said before, but again, this stuff is subtle yet important, so it's fine that we're overlapping it. Again, this point, Rothbard stresses it again, that in the ERE, capital goods don't earn any net rents. So let me just say that again in my own words to make sure you're grasping that point. Every factor, every productive factor, whether it's a capital good, a land factor, and remember, land doesn't just mean real estate. It also means natural resources in general, as long as they're indestructible. So if you're talking about like a geyser that shoots out hot steam that somehow the power companies can harness, or you're talking about a waterfall that the utilities can harness to generate electricity, for all intents and purposes, you're not diminishing those natural processes by tapping into it. I mean, a physicist will tell you technically you are, but for all intents and purposes, by putting a water wheel under a waterfall, or a turbine under a waterfall so that it spins, or other mechanisms you could use, or tapping into the geothermal energy of the earth and using the heat inside the earth's crust to generate electricity and so forth. For all intents and purposes, you could do that forever, or for at least thousands of years, well beyond anyone's planning horizon. So you can treat all that stuff as land factors too that would earn rents in the ERE. Just the same way a laborer can keep working day after day in the ERE. In the real world, of course, the worker's eventually going to die, but in the ERE, they don't die. All right, so all that is true, and they all earn a gross rent, and so does the capital good. So if there's a tractor in the ERE, that earns a gross rent as well. But what's the difference is, Rothbard saying the capital goods don't earn any net rents, because since those things are, there's a couple different ways of thinking about it. Since those capital goods are produced, you can trace back and through their history, the chronology of a capital good, and you can see, well, what were the payments that were made along the way to bring this thing into existence. And what you'll find, as long as this whole history is itself part of the ERE, is that once you take into account how much you had to pay at each stage along the way to bring this capital good to its current position, and you account for the time delay between those earlier expenditures and the capital value or the capital goods gross rent right now, then you'll see that on net, there are no rents from the existence of this capital good. Putting it another way, or one way to see why this has to be true, if you could spend money hiring labor factors and buying natural resources or hiring the use of natural resources in order to create a capital good, that you then could rent out to others and earn gross rents such that even accounting for interest on the delay of the time involved, on the time delay involved, excuse me, you were on net, you had money left over. In other words, that the gross revenue you were getting from hiring out that capital good was more than enough to cover the payments you had to make creating it, even taking into account the time difference, the fact that you had to make the payments earlier and you're only renting out the capital good later on after it's produced, if that were the case, then that means there'd be pure profits on the table, right? Because in the ERE, all the capitalists are only supposed to be able to earn the going rate of interest no matter how they invest their funds. So if there's some capital good out there that's earning gross rents that are over and above the properly, you know, time discounted payments necessary to create the thing, then that means there's a higher rate of return available by investing in the creation of those capital goods. So that would get squeezed out of existence. So it wouldn't be the ERE if that were true. Okay, so that's another way of thinking about it, that more and more such capital goods are going to be produced until the point at which their gross rents have been pushed down and or the prices of the factors needed to make them have been pushed up to squeeze out those above interest returns. And so that when all is said and done, in the ERE, a capital good, yes, it earns a gross rent, but it earns no net rent. Now, why does a worker earn a net, you know, why don't you say the same thing with the worker? Well, because you can't bring a work, you can't just create more workers the way you can create more tractors. I mean, so, you know, you can make jokes involving innuendo if you want about how do you create more workers, but you get what I'm saying. And the same thing is also true with land. Now, we're going to see later on in today's lecture that there is a sense in which the amount of land that's being used in the production process is variable and depends on economic conditions, but it's not true. You can't say, oh, well, there's this really arable piece of land that we're growing grapes on that are used to make champagne, and the owner of that land enjoys a return every period for it. So if that's true, you know, over and above how much he has to pay the workers to go pick the grapes. All right, so in terms of what the monetary expenditures that the landowner has to make in order to get this perpetual flow of grapes that he then in turn sells to the producers of champagne, there is a net return there. So the owner of the land earns a net rent. So meaning that the gross rent is high enough to cover all of his monetary expenditures, even adjusting for the rate of interest. Okay, so even though he pays wages to the workers, even if you let that payment grow with interest to the point at which he sells the grapes, still the revenue he gets from selling the grapes is higher than what he had to pay the workers to pick the grapes. So the fact that he owns that land means he earns a net income. Whereas the guy who's in the business of making tractors, he doesn't earn a net income in that sense. That once you take account of how much he had to pay the owners of other capital goods, assuming he's not making the tractor from scratch, you know, if he's buying engine parts and wheels and things like that, he has to buy other capital goods. So once you take into account all the inputs, what he needs to spend in order to make the tractor, and then he sells it, how much does he get for it? It's true, he's going to get more for the tractor than he spent on everything else, but the point is, once you adjust for the time difference and the time value of money, then they're equal. So let me say that again, because that's pretty crucial. Even for capital goods, it is still true in the ERE, the amount of total revenue you get when you sell the capital good to your customer, the total revenue you get is higher than the amount of money you spent on all the inputs to make it. But the reason we're saying you didn't earn a net rent is that difference is entirely accounted for by the time delay. So if you spent $100 or 100 ounces of gold buying the engine parts, buying the tires, buying the steering wheel, blah, 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 and hiring workers to assemble the tractor, and then next period you sell the tractor to a farmer for 105 ounces of gold, we don't say that you earned a net rent, because the 5 ounces of net income that you earn, it's not because of the tractor, it's because you were willing to wait. It's because of you deferring consumption that you invested your financial capital and were willing to wait one period. So that's where that 5 ounces of net income to you came from. That's interest income. That's not really an earning that the tractor garnered for you. That's the idea. Whereas, again, I'm just making sure you guys get this. If you owned land and you are renting it out to sharecroppers or something, then that's just a pure, think of it that way. Imagine you have no monetary expenditures at all. You just own a parcel of land, and you're allowing sharecroppers to come in, and they're paying you 105 ounces of gold every year for the right to use your land. You don't have any expenses at all. So that's a net income to you as a landowner. Or if you're a worker and you sell your labor services, or if you want to hire out your body to go work in a factory or something, the income you're earning, assuming, we don't make an argument about you took a really stressful job and that physically degraded your body or something, but assuming your body is in the same capacity day after day, your selling of your labor power, your labor hours, is a total net income to you, that you can go consume that, because you don't have to pay money in order to regenerate your labor power. That's the idea. Okay. What I just talked about there, that's kind of big picture stuff, so make sure you understand that. This slide right here, this is a little subtle, so I'm not going to quiz you on this part, but I do want to address this, because I'm not saying Rothbard contradicted himself, but he says things in different parts of the book that might be confusing people, so let me try to clear that up. All right, so this question. Didn't we go over earlier, I think it was at the beginning of lecture 6 is when I talked about this. Didn't I make a big deal at the time about Rothbard saying that in the ERE there's only two in what he called ultimate income sources that were interest and wages? And yet now, what I just talked about 2 minutes ago, it seems like Rothbard is saying there's three sources of income in the ERE. People that can earn net income from either wages, land factors, or interest. And so what's going on? Is Rothbard contradicting himself, or is there a subtle difference going on and he's actually being consistent? So in particular, the issue is, look at what I just did. Look at how I explained the way that the capital goods. I said that if you're in the business of producing tractors, yes, it's true, you can sell the tractor for 105 ounces of gold, but if you look at what you had to spend in producing the tractor, then that was only 100 ounces of gold, but that net five, that gap of five, the markup, we're not going to count that as net income accruing to the tractor. Rather, we should count that as net income accruing to you as a capitalist, because you invested your financial capital for one period, that you're earning interest. Okay? But didn't we do a similar trick with land? Didn't I say, the fact that you can rent out your land to sharecroppers for 100 ounces of gold every period, but why should we count that as a net rent or net return to you, since maybe I had to pay 1,000 ounces of gold up front for that land? And so really, every period, that 100 ounces, I should have said 10,000 ounces. It depends what the interest rate is. Let's say I paid 1,000 ounces of gold and I earn 100 ounces. So if the interest rate's 10%, that's why. So if I've explained away the earnings to the tractor producer and said, no, not really, it's not that the tractor's earning a net income, that's really just interest on the invested capital. Couldn't I say the same thing about the land factor? That, yeah, I'm a landowner, and in the ERE, I'm renting the thing out for 100 ounces a time period, per time period, but look at how I got the land in the first place. I had to pay someone 1,000 ounces of gold for it, and so really, we should be booking this as just interest income on my invested capital. So there's two possible resolutions. One is that Rothbard just had a slip of the typewriter, and that in that earlier passage that we talked about at the beginning of lecture six, he should have said included labor, or sorry, land factors as well. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that he's thinking of it in terms of the people who acquired virgin land. Okay, so I'm not gonna. It's not so much which position is right. I just want you to understand, depending on how you're thinking of it, you would go one way or the other. And I think that's partly why there's this apparent inconsistency, because I think actually what happened probably is Rothbard, in that earlier discussion that I talked about in the beginning of Lecture 6, I think he was thinking about one consideration, and then now I think he's thinking about something else. And like I say, at first it looks like there's a contradiction, but as long as you know what he's thinking of and what's making him say the one thing and the other, that's the important thing. So so it is true that if you pay 1,000 ounces of gold for a piece of land and then you're renting it out for 100 ounces each period, that's just interest income. So yes, you earn a net income of 100 ounces of gold each period. If you're doing the diagram, the 100 ounces would be shooting out to the side, because every period in the ERE, once you've acquired it, you're not paying anything out. But if you traced it all the way back to when you originally acquired it, you paid that 1,000 ounces. You see? So it's not, it's a little bit tricky, because remember I told you guys, when you're first learning it, the way you want to interpret that Hayekian triangle structure is to think of goods in process, that you're going to get all screwed up if you try to think of a fixed, durable capital good, like an oven, as opposed to the flour that turns into the bread, that turns into the sliced loaves that are, in the back of the truck going to the grocery store. If you're thinking of the oven that sits in the baker's kitchen, and all the wheat and flour flow through that thing, and the oven just sits there at stage 7 or whatever, stage 5, then you get a little bit screwed up in terms of trying to understand the basic Austrian point. So if you think about owning a piece of land, there's that issue as well, that the land doesn't move down the production structure. The land just stays wherever it is. So if people are harvesting wheat at the top of the production structure, and that's the beginning of the process that eventually is going to make bread, it's not that the land rolled over from stage to stage. And so that original owner, the guy at the top of the stage or the pyramid there who owns the land, he's just pocketing the 100 ounces of gold that's paid to him every period for the guys who are picking his wheat. And so that's the sense in which that's a payment to a land factor. And so that's the arrow going up. But if you wanted to get really fancy about it, you could, zoom way out and say, well, no, at some point that guy paid 1,000 ounces of gold to somebody else to acquire the land. And then in that sense, it's not like the next period that new buyer made his money back. No, he paid 1,000, and then the next period only rented it out for 100. So at first it looks like, oh my gosh, he just lost a bunch of money. he paid $1,000 and is only selling the product for $100. He's getting killed. But no, because he still has that land. So he earns $100 the next period, but then 2 periods after he buys, he earns $100. 3 periods after he buys, he earns $100. See what I'm saying? So that's a totally different approach from what we're normally doing in those diagrams, where the capitalists at each stage pay a bunch of money acquiring factors, they mix them together, and then they sell the whole thing and just get rid of it next period, and they start over from scratch. That's not at all what's going on if what part of what you're doing as a capitalist is buying a piece of land and then renting it out. Okay? So that's part of what's going on here, and that's, I think, partly what's driving these apparently contradictory statements. They're not really contradictions. It's just it's hard to deal with somebody acquiring land in the standard Hayekian diagram framework. So what's going on here is there is an important difference between saying the guy who produces the capital good earns no net rents in the ERE. They can all be decomposed into payments to land factors and labor factors and interest. There's a difference between saying that and saying in the ERE, somebody who bought land is only earning, in a sense, interest on the invested capital period after period. And the difference is the land was not physically produced. That was a gift from nature. So you want to include, okay, that guy in the second scenario who bought the land for 1,000 ounces, that 1,000 ounces isn't gone. He gave the 1,000 ounces to somebody else. And you can say, well, where did that guy get the land from? Well, maybe he bought it from somebody. You could keep tracing it back. But the point is, as long as this was always a free market, at some point, that land came into someone's possession who was the first user, the person who homesteaded the land that was originally in a state of nature that had no owner. Whereas the capital good, it's not like somebody stumbled upon this capital good that Martians left. In that case, the capital good would have had a net rent. The person who discovered it would have had a windfall income of 105 ounces of gold, since we're saying that was the market price of the finished capital good, the tractor. But that's not where the tractor came from. It had to be produced. Whereas the land was a gift from nature all along, and it's true if we just arbitrarily start the analysis with somebody who bought the land from somebody else in the ERE, then yeah, that guy is not earning a net rent from his possession of the land. He's only earning an interest return on his capital. But the first person who found the land did get that windfall. Okay, so anyway, I should move on because this is a very subtle point. I don't want to confuse you guys by getting really technical, but it's the point here on this slide is not for me to tell you one way or the other is the right way to think about this, and I'm not going to quiz you on something that's so subtle, but I'm hoping for each of my separate trains of thought there you could follow what I was talking about. That's really the issue. And so if you need to listen to this lecture again, that's fine. And like I said, but the focus should be don't worry about sketching out the argument and trying to decide which one's right. It's not that one's right or wrong. It's just there's different trains of thought, and depending on what problem you're trying to solve, you can go one way or the other with it. And I'm just explaining to you again why earlier, two lectures ago, I talked about how, in a sense, you can think of the landowner as not earning a net rent, that really, from the land, it's more a return on his invested capital, and yet in this lecture, I'm telling you that the landowner earns a net rent in the ERE, and I'm just explaining why that apparent contradiction is there. Okay, so now we'll move on to stuff where there's no apparent contradictions, and it's pretty straightforward. So labor, Rothbard has a nice little discussion of labor. Some of this is pretty obvious, but make sure you guys aren't getting lost. So all productive factors are rented out, even labor. So one way to think about it is that the laborer is renting out his body, and the higher price know, you can think of it as a rental payment. It's just that we have a special word for that when the factor is labor, and we call it the wage, or the wage rate, meaning the rental price per unit of time. One important difference between labor and other productive factors is that on the free market, Rothbard says, you can't capitalize the future expected flows of rental payments into the present discounted value, which would be the current market price of purchasing the asset. So you can have a piece of farmland and think that you can rent it out every day every year for 100 ounces of gold, and if the interest rate's 10%, you'd say, okay, so now the capitalized present discounted market value of that piece of land is 1,000 ounces of gold. You might think, well, if there's a worker who every year can earn wages of 100 ounces of gold, and assume the worker's going to live forever, can't we capitalize that and say the worker's body is worth 1,000 ounces of gold if the interest rate is 10%? And Robert say, no, it doesn't make any sense because that would be slavery, or it doesn't make sense in the free market. So actually, that is what you would do if you wanted to do the economic analysis of slavery. In that case, if you wanted to drop your moral misgivings and just do a neutral analysis, that's how you would do it. You would look at a human being who's a slave just like you would look at a horse or a machine. And you would need to take into account if the slaves could reproduce and stuff, too. Again, I'm not trying to be scandalous here. I'm just saying that that's the way you would think about it. Because it's not just the labor power that the slave's going to give over his or her lifetime, but if they're going to produce future slaves that legally you have the right to own, you would take that into account. Okay, so that's the way you would do it. But Rothbard's saying on a free market, we don't think like that because you can't buy and sell human beings. And that's also why, like I said in earlier lectures, a lot of Austrians don't like this term human capital, even though that's a very common mainstream concept. And they talk about, people go to college or they go to, they pay firms to give them training and stuff, or they go get validated by Microsoft that they're, experts in such and such software to increase their human capital. That's a very typical mainstream way of thinking, and a lot of Austrians don't like that because they think that that's an abusive language and it's mixing things up, that no, workers, you shouldn't think of them as walking capital goods, because that's just, and by the way, it's not merely, it's not just like, ooh, it's icky. There's something more substantive involved. So it's not just that Rothbard thinks it's icky to think about human beings as being capitalized wages, and therefore, that sounds like slavery, and I don't like thinking like that. That's not what the problem is. The problem is we don't actually have any market prices for the so-called human capital, because you can't in this world, except, for the places where slavery still exists, you can't actually sell yourself to somebody else. So Rothbard's point is, whereas we can go look out of where the prices of tractors and what's the price of a parcel of land. We actually have market prices for those things. So the point is, at best, it's metaphorical to talk about human capital, since you can't really buy and sell human capital goods. So that's what's going on. It's not simply squeamishness and that smacks of slavery. It's that, you mainstream guys who are talking about human capital, you're just drawing a bunch of curves in your peer-reviewed diagram or journals that has no basis in reality, that you have no idea what you're talking about, whereas we really do have actual market prices for actual capital goods. So that's partly why the Austrians reject this concept of human capital. It's not mere squeamishness. Okay, the other thing is that Mises pointed this out, and Rothbard picks it up. He says that this is not an a priori thing, but it happens to be the case in our world, at least since the flourishing of the market economy, that empirically, labor is more scarce than land. And so that's why in equilibrium we see there is sub-marginal land. There's plenty of land out there, both the actual, you know, layman's use of the term land and natural resources in general, that are not being used by industry. They're just lying fallow and they have zero price. Whereas there is not much submarginal labor to speak of. Now, and so in equilibrium, all labor factors are employed, and yet there's a bunch of land that's not being used. And the point is that's not inefficient. It's not that the market's screwing up, and oh my gosh, there's all this, you know, all these fish swimming around the ocean that aren't being caught, and there's all this oil that's, you know, if you went out into the middle of the ocean and went down 60 miles and drilled, you know, partway to China or whatever, there's 2 barrels of oil down there. So how come the market's not getting that stuff? And the reason's obvious, because it wouldn't be worth it. They'd be stupid to do that. So even though there's at any given time a lot of unemployed land, that's not evidence of something being wrong with the market. Whereas if at any given time there's 10% of the labor force is unemployed, then we know something's screwy. But that's not really equilibrium, or that's not, I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's not a market equilibrium, a free market equilibrium. Something's messed up. Whereas it is totally fine if 90% of the available land resources actually aren't being used, because and the way Mises and Rothbard would explain it is they would say that labor is more scarce than land. And again, that is an empirical fact. That's not an a priori thing. They say we can imagine a world where labor is more bountiful than land relatively. What do you mean? How do you compare labor to land? I mean, those are disparate things. They have different units and so forth. What they mean is, in equilibrium, even if there's no mistakes, you know, entrepreneurs have predicted everything correctly, which type of productive factor is going to be idle or have some of its stock be idle? And they're saying in our world right now it's land, but we could imagine having a world where either the land is so, you know, has been reduced, or the population has increased so much that things flip, and then all the available land is being used in the production processes, but some workers, there's just nothing for them to do, that their marginal product is negative. So that's why businesses aren't hiring them. They even, you know, even to work for free, they would be hurting things. They would, you know, the business, if those guys tried to help out, they would actually reduce output in monetary terms. And so that's why businesses won't hire them. And so they would be sub-marginal workers. So I should also clarify, in case you're, I mean, in the real world right now, technically, there are sub-marginal workers. I mean, there are some people that, like a guy who's a real violent person, and you put him in a room with somebody else, and he's going to just start punching the guy. I mean, that what's his marginal product? It's negative. Nobody's going to give him a job. He would have to pay you to take him into your factory. So he'd actually have a negative wage. So that guy's a sub-marginal, but you get the idea. That seems like a quirk. It's not like you can just arrange the amount of, you know, the spectrum of workers, and then there's a cutoff point the way there is with land. Rothbard has this interesting little discussion where he points out that this standard Marxist, and perhaps more generally, I guess, leftist or progressive, whatever you want to call it, idea that there's this schism between labor and management is actually nonsense. That in terms of economic categories or roles, the line worker, you know, the the rank and file blue collar guy who goes and works on the assembly line. That person is part of labor, sure, but so is the mid-level manager. In fact, so is arguably even the CEO. That really the owners of the company, the shareholders, are the ones who hire everybody else. So everyone else is actually an agent of the shareholders. Now, it's true when you start getting into the CEO and the vice presidents and so on, if their compensation package isn't just a fixed salary, but it's like they're getting stock and stuff like that, then technically that line gets blurred, but that's because they're now partly shareholders. You know, they're part owners of the company. They're part of the capitalists who are now taking on risk, or uncertainty, I should say, by owning this company, and so they're going to get, if it's profitable, they're going to get to enjoy a share of those profits. If there's losses, they're going to participate in those losses, whereas the blue-collar worker working on the assembly line, his pay package isn't structured that way. He's just getting whatever he's getting, $15 an hour, and that's it. Okay, so again, what I'm pointing out is that when you start, if this part of the book struck you as a little bit naive, it's only because actually in the real world, these upper-level management guys that you're thinking of is, oh, come on, they're halfway between the shareholders and the workers. Right, but that's because their pay package is making them part, you know, shareholders. That's why, and so that's entirely consistent with Rothbard's point. Okay, I touched on some of this before, but let me go over it now again. So when it comes to land, its higher price is called rent, and that's what everybody thinks of as rent. I mean, I guess actually, the average person thinks of rent as being due to his living quarters, so he pays rent to the landlord, but or you go rent a car. That's probably what the average person thinks of when you use the word rent. But economists historically, like the classical economists, they thought of rent as being the type of income earned by landowners. And then they thought wages are earned by labor, and interest is earned by capital. That was the way that the classical economists thought about things. But what I'm telling you is that classical understanding got transformed with the marginal subjectivist revolution and just the modern approach to price theory. That now we don't reserve the term rent to mean the type of income earned by landowners. No, rent is now a much broader concept, and it means that is the higher price of any productive factor, even labor. It's just that with labor, for historical reasons, largely, we usually say, okay, yeah, the rental price of a worker is really called a wage rate. But strictly speaking, the worker earns rents too. We just call them wages. And capital goods earn rents also. And we didn't learn. So yeah, that those payments are interest, but we already talked about the process where it's kind of both. And interest, again, is also implicitly earned on land factors too. When you buy land and then earn rents on it, in a sense, those payments are interest on the capital that you pumped into buying the land. Okay, so the way Rothbard thinks about this, and this isn't something that's specifically Austrian, this is pretty general, is that you different units of land have different productivities. And there's various reasons for that. You know, obviously, if you're talking about farmland, some farmland is just more fertile than others. That for a given application of seed and fertilizer and water and whatever else, you're just going to get a bigger harvest. You're going to get more crops per acre on some pieces of land than on other pieces of land, right? So real rocky terrain that's near the ocean that, you know, that half the time has, you know, the tide comes in and the salt water's on it, and then you're not going to be able to grow a lot of orange trees right there, whereas certain areas in Florida, you're going to be able to get a lot more oranges per acre there than you will on the rocky terrain right next to the ocean. So there's that aspect, but also you can think of it in terms of like proximity to a coal mine or something. You know, some of the land would be more productive that way. So you can, Robert, you can arrange land on a spectrum in terms of the gross rents that it could earn from greatest to least. And so then at some cutoff point, the land to one end of, you know, on one side of that spectrum is going to have negative rents, so it's just not going to be used. So its market price will be zero, and the rent that it earns will be zero. That no one's going to start using it and demand payment from the owner of a certain amount, meaning it earns negative rent. That's not how it's going to be. No one's, they're just not going to use it. And then there's a certain plot of land called the marginal plot that is used in production, but it earns a very low rent. And then everything to the other side of that is supra-marginal land that earns rents. And so the more productive you get, the more the rent is. So Rothbard, I'm not going to get into it here. I don't have any slides dealing with it. There is this whole tradition in economics dealing with rents where it's like the difference between the really good land and the marginal land. And Rothbard talks about that. If you're interested, you can read that. I'm not getting into it because that's more of a history of thought thing. And I think it just is going to confuse you. But the way we do it now, or the way at least Austrians do it, is rent just means the absolute amount for which you rent the land. And so if you can rent one parcel of land for 50 ounces of gold and another parcel for 30 ounces, that's what you say. And yeah, you can say that there's a 20 ounce gap between the two, but Rothbard doesn't want to call that rent. He just wants to know you earned 50 ounces of rent on the first piece and 30 ounces on the second piece. That's it, end of story. And how do we explain that? You don't need to refer to other pieces of land. You just need to look at, well, because people who use the more fertile piece of land, their profits go up by 50 ounces when they use it. And so in equilibrium, they have to pay the owners of that land 50 ounces to be able to use it, because everything earns its margin, its discounted marginal value product. Okay, Rothbard has a little discussion here, and I just want to clarify what he's saying. He says, on the one hand, he says, in general, if we're just talking about in general, how are we using a specific factor, then the supply curve of it is going to be vertical. And then the demand for that particular factor is going to, where they intersect is going to determine the price. So if the demand for that particular factor goes up, the price goes up, but the quantity is not going to shift. But that's for a general use. Whereas he says for a particular use of a land factor, the supply curve is going to be upward sloping, because the idea is, and so in particular, like if the demand shifted to the right, not only would the price earned by that land factor go up, but it would go up, but the quantity of land devoted to that particular use would go up also. So I'm trying to think of a good analogy for what he means here. So the idea is, if you have land in general, there's a big plot of farmland, it's going to be used for agriculture one way or the other. So no matter what the demand for oranges is, you know that every acre of that particular area is going to be in cultivation and going to be used. But if you're talking about how much of that is going to be used for growing oranges versus growing something else, Well, then, that's using a particular use of the land factor, and so then, depending on the demand for oranges, that could influence how much acreage is devoted to growing oranges. Whereas, the total acreage devoted to agriculture, that's not going to change based on the demand for oranges. Okay, that's the kind of thing Rothbard's getting at here. Now, it gets really tricky depending on how generic or not you make these categories. You can get into trouble because we said that the amount of total land being used is itself determined by economic forces. So, strictly speaking, it's not like there's a set amount of agricultural land no matter what. If the demand for food goes way up, then some stuff that was previously used for housing gets turned into being used for agriculture, let's say. And even stuff that before was sub-marginal now becomes supra-marginal, and maybe people start planting on it. Okay, but in any event, I'm just trying to clarify what Rothbard has in mind with these two diagrams. And let me just see how many slides I have left. Okay, just to pace myself. Okay, land speculation. This is actually a really neat topic. Rothbard does talk about a critique of Henry George, but I think that comes later on in Man, Economy, and State. I think it comes when he's dealing with taxation and Henry George's proposal for a single tax on land. That's one of the neatest parts of the book, in my opinion. But anyway, right now, I mean, so Rothbard gets into a little bit of that stuff in this chapter that you guys are reading right now. So, one point he makes is that people, you need to understand where he's coming from. Critics of capitalism will say, oh my gosh, these evil speculators, they're withholding productive resources from human beings' use just for their own narrow profit. This is awful. Because they look out and they see that there's perfectly good land that's idle. And they say, that doesn't make any sense. Why aren't they using that? And if you inquire as to, well, somebody owns that land, right? So you're driving down through, through a city, and you see apartment buildings, you see grocery stores, and then you see, what the heck? There's a vacant lot, right? Either there's nothing physically there, or if there's buildings, there's a few buildings that are empty, that don't have any businesses in them, and the Marxist or somebody will look at that and say, what the heck is going on? We could use that. If there was a socialist central planner, he would be using that land. This is a busy city. Land is very valuable. This is crazy that this stuff is not being used. And if you asked what's going on, the answer, of course, would be, well, the owner thinks he can make more money by waiting. And so Rothbard is pointing out two things here. He says, first of all, this isn't such a big problem. Like, it's not going to be a long-term problem, because unlike somebody who is speculating by buying, I don't know, I'm trying to think of something, cans of tuna fish, let's say, somebody who thinks the price of tuna is going to go way up, that person has to withdraw the tuna fish from the market and hold it off the market, and then wait till he thinks the price is right and then sell them. And so, yeah, people can't consume that tuna fish while he's hoarding it. But Rothbard says with land, the thing about land is you can use it in the present, and that's not going to make it unavailable for future use. So even if you think that 10 years from now the rent on this parcel of land is going to be much higher than it is now, it's not like you as a speculator have to buy the land now and not let anybody use it for 10 years. You can buy it now and rent it out right now and for the next 9 years, and then you'll still have the land when the rental price goes up to where you're thinking it will go up to. So that's one point Rothbard makes, that when it comes to land factors, this issue of speculators withholding it, it's not nearly as much of a problem. Not that it's a problem in any event, but there's not even an apparent problem as it is with other factors. But then he says, but having said that, okay, we can imagine situations where a speculator or where an owner for speculative reasons would keep the land idle, even though it's supra-marginal land. And that's because even though in its pure form a land factor is indestructible, nonetheless, in reality, you can do things to a parcel of land. You know, you can make investments and so forth that are hard to reverse. So you wouldn't really want to start developing the land for one type of use if you thought that it was going to change in the future. So, for example, if you own a piece of land with stores in it, you know, you own a plot of land that's in a busy downtown area, and then one of the stores goes out of business, and so they leave, and so now you've got this, whatever, 5,000 square foot building space that you could rent out to a business. You probably won't rent it out and have somebody in there the day after the other business is kicked out, right? You're going to advertise it. You're going to put signs up saying for rent. You're maybe going to take out ads in the paper. You're maybe going to list it online with certain places to say you have a store for rent, and you're going to charge a price that you think you can get for it, and you're not just going to wait and just rent it out to the first person that calls you up. You're going to estimate the market, and you're going to think, okay, if I'm willing to look for a month or two, I can find the right renter and blah, blah, blah. Okay, so there, precisely because in the real world there's uncertainty, you're not sure exactly how much you can rent that thing out for. And so you're willing to spend a little time searching, because you don't want to rent, because the problem is you don't want to rent it to the first person that walks in and then find out a week later, oh shoot, there was somebody who would have paid me 10% more, because you can't, it's a pain. You can't have the one guy move in and then kick him right out and have someone else move in. That's just not the way it works. You know, that in the real world, if you're going to rent out a land factor, it's going to be for a long term and so on. So that explains why in the real world owners keep the land idle for a time period while they're searching for the best possible tenant or the best use of the land. I mean, it's even more obvious if you're thinking about building an apartment unit or something. You can't start building an apartment unit and then 2 weeks later it turns out, oh no, a shopping center would have been more useful, because once you start building the apartment unit, you know, those are sunk costs, true, but you get the idea. In the beginning, you don't want to go down that route unless you're sure. So that's what Rothbard is talking about, and he's saying if the speculators are right, then that's a good thing. You want them to withhold land and not start making irreversible decisions about how it's going to be used. You want them to keep it off the market while they determine what they think the best use is. That there, the interest of the landowner in his speculative capacity coincides with that of the consumers. You don't want him to start building an apartment unit if actually he would have made more building a shopping center. What that means is the consumers really want him to build a shopping center. Another little thing Rothbard talks about is that it's possible that you can have a parcel of land that currently isn't earning any rent. It's just idle. But yet, if you wanted to buy it from the owner, he would charge you a positive price for it. So that seems kind of odd, that you can have a parcel of land that is currently earning zero rent, and yet it has a positive capital value. And you see, isn't that a contradiction? I thought Rothbard said that the capital value, the purchase price of a land factor, is just the discounted stream of its future rental payments. And yeah, that's true, but if we're not in the ERE, people might be speculating that even though it's earning zero rent right now, it's going to earn positive rent in the future. So this is obvious, of course, if somebody, you know, buys a piece of land and demolishes the building that was on it originally and then starts building a new building, for those months of construction, the owner of that land is not earning any rent. But obviously, especially if it's in a very, lucrative market, that land still would have positive a positive price. Because there, even though right now, while you're building the new casino on it, you're not earning any revenues from owning it, you think that's going to change once the casino is finished. And then you're going to start earning a bunch of revenues, or sorry, a bunch of rents from that land. And so that's why right now it would still have a high positive market price, even though you as the owner aren't earning anything from it. Another easy example is if you own a piece of land that right now the government says you can't do anything with, like, you know, say it's swampland or something that's a few miles outside of a city, and right now it's protected by environmental regulations, you can't develop it because there's, you know, a spotted owl or whatever, an endangered fish. But you know that, you know, you're bribing the city council or whatever, or the public's really mad because unemployment's really high, and you think in the next election a bunch of right-wingers are going to come into power and they're going to remove those environmental regulations, so now you can drain the swamp and put it in a shopping mall and then earn a bunch of rents. For that speculative reason, you might, you know, hold on to that thing. So even if somebody walks by and says, hey, I see you own that piece of worthless swamp land, I'll give you $5 for it, you might say no, because there's a small chance that next year after the election I'm going to be able to develop that thing and start earning a nice monetary income from it. Okay, economics of population growth. So Rothbard says that as the population grows, other things equal, the marginal value product of land is going to go up too across the board. And so that means where that threshold is, the land that now it becomes marginal is going to move down the chain or move across the spectrum towards the less and less fertile land. So at any given time, all the best land is in cultivation, and the land that's not being used is the inferior land. But the point is that dividing line between what's good enough and what is inferior can change depending on other things. So other things equal, as population grows, that's going to tend to raise the market value of a given parcel of land, meaning it will make sense to bring more and more land under cultivation. When it comes to labor, there's two things going on. So on the one hand, just as with any factor, when the supply increases, you think it's, you know, on the margin, its value goes down, market value goes down. So that's true of labor too. Other things equal, as population grows, you would expect wage rates to go down. But there's another thing that you need to take account of, and that is the greater the population, the more opportunities there are for expanding the division of labor, or extending the division of labor. And so it's an empirical question as to which force is stronger. So one way to just think about that is, let's say there's a nuclear holocaust and just about everybody gets wiped out. And so you're walking around, you know, you and your family are the only people that survive as far as you know, and you're walking around, you got all these capital goods, and that's great, but, you know, in one sense you think you're really rich, but actually you're not, because you know it takes work, or you can't work the factories and stuff, you know, they're not, so there's that issue. But then you find some other people, so not only would you be happy that, oh great, we can swap stories and we can have human companionship, but even just in material terms, now your standard of living is going to be a lot higher. It's not like you're going to see those other three people and say, oh shoot, now we got to share everything with them. No, now the amount you guys can produce, given all these capital goods that no one's using now, and all these natural resources that all the owners are dead, you're going to be able to produce a heck of a lot more stuff, even per capita, now that you've found some other people and you can, you know, join forces and specialize, rather than everyone, you know, rather than you and your immediate family having to do everything. Now you can specialize in some things and have those people specialize in something else, even if you guys are all equally skilled, right? So it's not just an issue of, what if the guy over there is a good surgeon and none of us know anything about medicine? I'm not even talking about that. I'm saying even if you guys are all equally skilled, the fact that you now can specialize, you know, can expand, you can increase your productivity. So what this means is, if you think it through, economists can discuss an optimum population. And what that means is, for a given state of the various stocks of capital goods, technological know-how, supplies of natural resources, all that kind of stuff, there's an optimum population in the sense that there's a population such that that maximizes per capita output. And because the idea is, if you know those two effects we talked about, if we're on the other, the below that point, if we're below the optimum population size, as population grows, yes, there's the one effect of more people means that tends to push down the marginal product of labor, marginal productivity of labor, but that's more than offset by the enhanced division of labor. So actually the marginal product of labor is going up as population grows. But at some point, the one force gets stronger than the other. At some point, we've already taken advantage of the division of labor so much that increasing population on that score is giving lower and lower marginal benefits, and the other effect now is predominant. So at some point, if you increase the population, it's actually reducing the marginal product of labor. So wages are going down. Now, it's, don't misunderstand me. When we say optimum, the reason I put it in quotation marks, that's not, we're not saying efficient, or we're not saying that that's the right outcome or that's what the market would choose. That it's, you know, maybe we should even use a different term to avoid confusion. So there's no, nothing says that the consumers ought to, or households, I should say, ought to keep having children until the point at which they've maximized the long-term earning potential of their dynasty, which is kind of like what you would be saying. All right, so that, because that's the way to think about it, that, you know, these things that are true on a macro level also manifest themselves at the household level. And so if parents, so you will get these feedback effects, it's true. So if you're, if a society is in a situation where we're way beyond that so-called optimum population, so that as more people are being born, that's just pushing down wages, and people have to endure a lower and lower standard of living, probably individual households are not going to have as many kids. Because, you know, they're even when they're just making their own financial decisions, they're thinking, oh, man, you know, our kids are going to have a lower standard of living than we had, and, you know, they just might, you know, college costs are going to go up, and, you know, just the cost of raising a kid just keeps getting higher and higher each generation. This is crazy. For some reason, wages keep going down. Man, it's just too expensive. We better not have so many kids. And so if everyone does that, well, then the population starts shrinking, and you move back, right? So there is that issue, but the point is, there's no reason to say that the market's going to naturally gravitate towards the so-called optimum, and that's not because there's a market failure. It's because there's nothing saying that that really is what people ought to strive for. Okay, that it's not. There's nothing saying that. Just like there's economics doesn't say a worker ought to go to the job that pays him the most money. There's nothing in economics that says that's the efficient outcome. You can say there's tendencies, and other things equal, workers will take the job that pays them the most, measured in monetary terms. But if a worker quits his job at the hedge fund because he's just given too much stress, and he goes and works at the library, that's not inefficient. They're just, okay, he's just doing that which gives him the most utility. So the same thing with population size. There's no reason, if people are real claustrophobic, and they want to have a very sparse landscape, and people don't like living, you know, they only like having five people per square mile, there's nothing in economics that says they've chosen poorly, even if it's true that if they increase their population, they could have more goods and services each period, so what? There's other things besides the physical production of goods and services. Okay. As usual, I went longer than I planned on going, but let me see if there's any quick questions I can answer. While I'm loading this up, let me give a plug. Probably most of you have heard about it by this point, but I'm going to be debating on Friday, September 2nd at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm going to be debating Carl Smith on Keynesian economics. And so if you go look at the Mises blog, you can see that Smith is actually kind of a funny guy, and so the debate is actually, I think that'll be more interesting than I thought it was going to be a few days ago. I didn't realize what a funny guy Smith is. Okay, production. There's no questions. All right, well, that's good. We're actually at the time limit anyway. Okay, guys, well, thanks for tuning in. I will get your quizzes posted and send you out that email blast. And remember, if you're interested, you might want to check out and see that debate on this coming Friday. All right, thanks, everybody.